Hey everyone, a word about today's episode. After we were done recording, we discovered that we lost April's audio entirely, and we were really bummed out about that. And I've gone through and worked on this for over an hour now and managed to sort of rescue most of it. The quality is really bad, and anytime I interject anything or make any kind of noise or laugh or whatever, it cuts her out, and it's really just kind of bad quality. So I'm sorry about that. I apologize, but didn't want to just trash the entire episode. So I hope it doesn't hurt your ears too terribly much. We had a lot of fun recording it, and here you go.
So you just finished the latest episode.
Yes.
Excellent. Well, we got like 3 episodes to cover. I'm assuming you are freshest on this. Is there anything you want to jump into?
Listened to a lot of We Were More recently, so I have a lot in my head at once. I actually started with the very end of the 3rd episode we're covering with Beast Strange.
Yeah, that's true. We should probably backtrack. The very first episode 3 weeks ago, was that the one where Harry was talking to Dumbledore in his office?
Yes.
Okay, cool. So I do have one thing from there. Okay, so my first thing is that Brian mentioned that at the very beginning, like, Dumbledore asked Harry for his notes with his meeting with not Snape, damn it, Lucius. He said that, like, it seemed to him that this was a way of Dumbledore, like, putting Harry off guard, like, because Dumbledore obviously knew Harry wasn't really taking notes or anything, and this would, like, wrongfoot him, and so Harry wouldn't, like, really consider not lying to him then, because he's just taken off guard. And that had never occurred to me, like, in the slightest, but when he said that, I was like, oh my god, that is genius. And that's...
I don't remember how much of that was, like, Brian proposing that as a possibility, or him actually, like, thinking that was definitely what was going on.
Okay.
But yeah, I that idea never occurred to me. I guess I wasn't being properly suspicious of Dumbledore at this point.
Yeah, I think that I still had such a, you know, warm, fuzzy feeling for Dumbledore from the original canon books that I just, it didn't occur to me. But, like, looking back on it, yeah, Dumbledore is kind of, you know, he's a player. This is totally something I could see rationalist Dumbledore doing, and, like, I thought that was genius, and I'm really glad he pointed that out. Like, apparently I was not paranoid enough.
And, I mean, the most recent episode, or the chapter at the end of the most recent episode, ends with Harry resolving to look more into who Dumbledore really is, and I didn't realize that, like, the book was placing suspicion on Dumbledore this early on.
Yeah.
It's building up to the point where the book, like, really gets at, like, do we actually have a good reason to trust Dumbledore, other than him being a good person in canon?
Yeah.
Like, Brian is noticing this way earlier than I ever did.
Yeah, same here. I was pretty darn impressed by that. And speaking of that thing where Harry, now I'm skipping to the very end, like, literally the last section of the last chapter, but since you just brought it up, where Harry, like, decides he's got to investigate Dumbledore a bit, Brian was talking about, like, how it seemed unrealistic that Harry had this long Sherlockian chain of evidence that, you know, brought him to this conclusion. And that also, it didn't occur to me when I was first reading it, and it probably should have, but in the Discord, and this is not the Basin Conspiracy Discord, because now I'm on both the Basin Conspiracy and the Doofcast Discord, but in the Doofcast Discord, a Dad64 said that that it struck him as a time when Harry's unusually certain about something, the same way he was certain that magic was real, and that the whole thing is even prefaced with the logic presented itself with a strange diamond-like clarity, so that it was described the same way that, you know, he describes a lot of things that come with his dark side and Riddle's memories leaking in, and he pointed out that, like, his memory of Riddle's recollection of that event have just been jogged by the Dementor. Like, he literally just relived it. So this is probably information that he's getting from Tom Riddle's memories. And it's really not fair to Brian because he doesn't know this yet, right? Like, on second reading, we're like, oh, yeah, that makes sense. That's why he was so certain about magic in the first chapter. That's why he feels certain about this, too, because he has Voldemort's knowledge somewhere squirreled away. But I don't know. It was interesting that Brian picked up on he shouldn't have jumped to that conclusion, and I didn't. And I was impressed with that.
Yeah, that actually explains a lot. Because I was thinking, like, it's weird that this was never used as, like, a parable, I guess, on the conjunction fallacy.
Mm-hmm.
That Harry is making these deductions. I haven't actually read the passage, but, like, the deduction where he figures out that Quirrell is Voldemort, I don't remember. I feel like he went off in a lot of different ways with the logic there. But I don't remember if the, like, chain that actually ends up proving it is very complicated.
I don't remember it being too bad. Like, I followed it, and the whole time I found it plausible enough. It's just that, in retrospect, when he points out that's kind of implausible, I'm like, yeah, I guess. It didn't occur to me because, you know, technically Harry's right and we already know that. Since we read the canon trilogy and we know that is what happened. I think that's why it snuck past me.
Does that actually happen in canon? Where Dumbledore is...
Huh.
I haven't read canon in a while.
Crap. No, you're right. Now I don't know. Like, I've read Methods of Rationality so much more that maybe my memories are getting confused between the two.
Where did trilogy come from?
Did I say trilogy?
You said trilogy.
I meant series. It's a trilogy of seven. One of those.
Just like the Jacobs.
Exactly. But yeah, so that was the first thing I had from that first chapter episode thingy.
Brian also, like, thinks that when Dumbledore, like, asks to speak to Harry's quote unquote dark side. Brian describes as, like, pandering to Harry.
Yeah. I also picked up on that. I don't know. I don't consider it pandering because, like, Harry honestly is a unique genius and Dumbledore isn't insecure, so he can acknowledge that and not, you know, I don't know. I didn't think it was pandering at all. I thought he was just being honest. Like, did you think it was pandering?
I don't know, because, I mean, I do think that Dumbledore is phrasing in a way that he knows will appeal to Harry, but also, like, true to some extent, at least.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that counts as pandering exactly.
And again, we're stuck with the knowledge that we already know that Dumbledore knows that Harry is a copy of Tom Riddle. So...
several layers of meta.
Yeah, so Harry has unique insights into exactly what Tom Riddle, you know, might feel about things. So, I mean, in that case, it's definitely not pandering, but Brian doesn't have a way to know that, right?
I mean, not
yet. No. But I think, I don't know, Dumbledore just... I consider him more of a person who doesn't mind speaking the plain truth, and so I think that even if Harry wasn't Tom, he'd still, you know, if he thought that Harry had something unique to offer, he'd be like, well, you got this unique genius for being evil and dark, can you help me out? And that he wouldn't feel like, oh, I'm condescending to talk to a child, you know?
Yeah, that seems accurate.
I think one of the things I really like about Dumbledore, and a number of the wizards in Methods of Rationality, but particularly Dumbledore, he doesn't ever talk down to anyone just because they're, you know, less good of a wizard than him or less smart than him or younger than him. Like, to him, the age difference between Harry and adult is like, whatever. Sure, he's small, but he's got things to contribute too, which is, I really respect that, and I find that, like, when you treat kids more like real humans and adults that just aren't very mature yet, they tend to take it better, too, instead of treating them like, you know, toys.
I mean, that's definitely the case. And just, like, that entire conversation, Dumbledore is more or less talking to Harry as an equal.
Yeah.
Or not exactly as an equal, but, like you said, not as a toy.
And I can see how someone who loves hierarchies might think that that is pandering.
Look, I'm not.
That is my that is my hobby horse that I will beat. Like, he beats the Guildenstern and Dumbledore. That would be an awesome fanfic. The Rosencrantz and Guildenstern thing that they know they're in a story. I'm really curious as to how he's going to take it when he gets to the end of it, and it turns out that is not the case. Like, at what point is he going to start thinking, oh, maybe I was wrong, and then, like...
with the mirror.
Yeah, well, yeah. Are they in the mirror still?
That's not the Word of God interpretation, but the story doesn't exactly say anything.
Right.
It's perfect.
Yeah, once you've introduced perfect simulations into your story. But yes, you were about to say?
Brian identifies Quirrell as, like, he says, Harry's really fanboyish towards Quirrell, and he says, quote unquote, this is where Harry is at least rational.
Oh.
Which is, like, that is...
dead on accurate.
Exactly. And that's kind of a theme throughout the rest of the story up until the very end.
Yeah. I have a few people in the Doofcast Discord mentioned that they didn't like Quirrell because they're all strange, weird people over there that I don't understand. But they said they didn't like Quirrell because they think that he was, and they may have a point here, that Quirrell knew that, you know, Harry was a mind clone of him too, so he knew exactly what to do and what buttons to push to make Harry, like, hero worship him the whole time. And I don't know. My response to that was, like, you should always strive to be the person that young you would have idolized, right? Like, that's a worthy goal. But then several people were like, no, the kind of person young me would have idolized would have been terrible, and someone who would have known that about me and taken advantage of that would also be a terrible person. And I'm like, all right, well, I guess that's you.
I mean, Quirrell is objectively a terrible person. Can you just be
He's a little evil. He's got a tinge of the evil to him.
He is really cool.
Yeah.
I like the character.
Yeah.
As a person?
Yeah, no, you're right.
There could be a person who resembles Quirrell in a lot of ways that's still, like, cool. But,
yeah, a real Quirrell in the real world would need to be locked up.
There's a few things about his past that I have reservations.
Yes. Even about his present when he takes off the mask at last.
Even when the mask is on, he's doing things behind the scenes.
Yeah, yeah, it's true. Ooh, that Groundhog Day-ing of Hermione. And then the murdering of Hermione. One thing I did appreciate about this is that, so I dislike, for the most part, the fancy education of English and fiction, and I will rail on that a little bit later. But in the Discord, Brian did, in the TBC Discord, Brian did expound a bit on Heathcliff from one of the classic works of English literature a couple centuries ago. I don't even remember which one it is. But apparently Heathcliff is like the archetype of the Quirrell character, like the first one, where he's a person that by the standards of the day was a very bad person, and all the readers, like, rightly hate him because they are not immoral bastards, but also all the readers secretly love him, and, you know, not even secretly, because he's like, hey, he's charismatic and he's awesome, and he's like Quirrell. You want to love him even though you know he's evil. So, you know, he referred to Quirrell being like Heathcliff, and me and a bunch of other people were like, I'm sorry, we're uneducated schlubs. Can you please explain? And then he explained all this, and we were like, oh, so like Quirrell. And he was like, yes. So that was fun. I learned a little bit something about English literature and the history of it. Speaking of, if I can jump on the next thing?
Sure.
Okay. I don't understand. So here's the difference between the episode we heard 3 episodes ago and the one we just heard. In the one 3 episodes ago where Harry is talking with Dumbledore in his office, Brian's put off that Dumbledore talks like, you know, a fantasy book character. He talks like Gandalf would, you know? And I never had a problem with that because, first of all, he's the wise old wizard, you know? Like, that is his character, and I believe he talked like that in Rowling stories too. And like, Dumbledore was like, yeah, no one talks like this. And I'm like, yeah, right, because no one is a wise old wizard in the real world. But it's awesome when he does it. And, like, I couldn't understand why he had a problem with that. But then in the latest episode, they were talking about when Dumbledore says, fetch Minerva and tell her that she must come at speed. And they're saying, like, how awesome it is that Dumbledore talks like this old wizard from old-timey fantasy books. And I'm like, I agree, but Brian, what is going on? What happened to consistency? And I don't know. Maybe he's coming over to our side of seeing things and just enjoying stuff for the enjoyment of it more, or it's weird seeing that kind of turnaround in just the space of 3 weeks, you know?
I mean, he definitely really enjoyed the humanism, like, arc where Harry defeats the mentor, which I think has been a sticking point for a lot of people who don't like the book.
Oh. I suppose if you already dislike the book, you're gonna hate that too.
Yeah, like, if you're not on board with if that note doesn't hit, it's gonna be really jarring.
Yeah, yeah. I especially love the part when they were talking, Brian and Steven were talking about, like, the going to the stars aspect of things and, like, launching rockets and landing them again and how fucking cool that was and how they teared up seeing that kind of thing when Musk landed his rockets and, like, just the wonder and awesomeness of humans doing this and getting off this planet and exploring the stars and, like, I mean, that made me fall in love with Brian a little more because I was like, hey, he knows. He's one of us, you know? That is awesome stuff. And I think that was, like, one of the things I was most worried about, that when he got to that, he would be like, ugh, what a bunch of nerds, you know, getting all teary-eyed about this. But then when he was into it, too, I was like, that is fantastic, Brian. You rule. Although then, afterwards, he tried to make it personal with the actual Patronus 2.0, which I thought was weird.
I saw people, like, confused about that in Discord when the episode personal out. I'm not into cast Discord out. So, the basic conspiracy one.
Yeah, that was entirely on basic conspiracy, that part.
And, I mean, I sort of, like, feel like people aren't understanding where Brian is coming from.
Mm-hmm.
The personal connection is relevant. Like Steven mentioned, Itkowski's essay, or, like, eulogy for his brother dying.
Yeah.
And, like, that is stronger because you know of, like, a personal connection that, like, Itkowski was grieving over the loss of his brother.
Yeah.
And, like, I think those are strong emotions, and they are tied to the sentiments Harry was expressing, and that including them, I don't know if it would have actually improved the writing of Muffet's rationality, because I feel like that wasn't really about Harry in particular at that point in time, it was about the general concept of humans overcoming death.
Yeah, exactly.
I feel like Brian was seeing it more as from Harry in particular's perspective.
I mean, I know what you're saying, but, and I brought this up in the Discord to Brian personally, that I don't think that would have made anything better, because, like, Yudkowsky's essay, oh my god, when I read that, I cried. It's powerful and incredible. But the, like, Harry doesn't have anyone in his life like that that's died on him. He doesn't remember his parents at all. He was one when they died. And this really is much more about, like, all of humanity coming together and working together to overcome this scourge that has plagued us forever and going beyond it and reaching to what we can become. And to, like, try to force in some sort of, like, and you killed my father, you son of a bitch thing. It feels to me like it would cheapen it instead of making it better. Like, that is not Harry's motivation. That has never been his motivation, but we have seen throughout the story on many occasions where Harry's motivation is to optimize the world. That, you know, he says, I don't call it world domination, call it world optimization in, like, chapter 6, right? Like, and then when Lysoth begs him to save his parents and he can't, and he feels absolutely terrible, and he admits that, like, he wants to prevent all suffering for all people, and he feels terrible when they can't. Like, that is his theme and his motivation. And so this part was really true to Harry's character. And if it had tried to bring in something that hasn't been set up in the story and really has nowhere to come to, I think it would have been terrible. Like, I don't know why he wanted that. Like, he kept calling it too intellectual or whatever. I'm like, what is intellectual about these emotions?
I feel like I don't think Ryan had any problem with what there was there. I think he, like, understands that, like, vision of, you know, the world as a whole coming together.
Mm.
I think he all, like, now, there isn't much setup for Harry being particularly upset about his parents' death. But I think Ryan's thinking that, like, it doesn't take anything away to, like, add additional motivation there. It just, like, I mean, he described it as multiplying it together, I think.
Yeah, but I think he's wrong. I think it would have made it worse.
Methods of rationality, I think this was better. I think there could be similar stories where adding the additional aspect could make it stronger, but Harry's character does not work like that, I don't think.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Different stories call for different methods. They can't all be the same story. I don't know. What was it here? I'm scrolling through my notes. Here it was. He said that Eliezer was guarded and intellectual and didn't really let fly with the emotion of the scene. And I'm like...
not use those words to describe.
No, not at all. It was the opposite of guarded and intellectual. It was like bursting with emotion and... Like, it was one of the most inspirational things I've read in fiction, period. You know, it's in my top 10, definitely. Maybe top 5. It's like, how do you call that guarded and intellectual?
I feel like most people who dislike the book and, like, have a problem with that scene think it's, like, too cheesy because of how emotional it is.
Right. It's, like, the opposite.
I don't really understand Ryan's perspective here. Not emotional. I don't think that's what exactly he was trying to get at. I think he was probably not. I'm not sure if misspeaking is the right word, but.
I kind of get the feeling, because, like, he said this before, like, when Neville was talking about why Bellatrix was a terrible person that deserved to be in Azkaban. He said that, like, that was also intellectual and kind of detached, and I think just the fact that people are able to form coherent thoughts and dive into, I don't know, complex logic chains while they're feeling emotions seems to him artificial for some reason, and I don't know why, because as someone who often gets wrapped up in my own thoughts, like, sometimes they lead to the most overwhelming emotions, you know? Not good often, but like, you can have emotions sparked by your thoughts, and you can keep thinking things while you're feeling emotions. It's not always just raw screaming to the heavens and rending your garments, in my opinion.
I feel like a lot of my most emotional moments come when I'm, like, trying to consider scope neglect, like, and that, like, my system, one, I guess, is not really thinking about what scope neglect is, but, like, when I have that component of, like, considering that, like, I'm getting upset about this, but, like, that's really just a thousand, a million of the actual problem.
Yeah.
Helps me, like, actually come to terms with, like, the scope of the problems in the world.
Yeah. Yeah, like, when Eliezer ends that essay about his brother's death, saying that, or maybe this was in Methods of Rationality, I don't remember, possibly in both, but yeah, saying that the sun should have flickered due to such a horrible thing happening, and realizing that the sun would be basically a nonstop strobe due to how many people die every minute, and like, that really hammers that home too, that one emotion, and how much it should be multiplied. And I don't know, like, Not Brian. I'm sorry. I don't want this to be about Brian. Like, I guess I'm understanding more and more how varied people can be, because the sort of brain that, like, thinks, oh, if you're having rational thoughts at a moment, it means that you're being guarded and intellectual and aren't feeling things is just so very foreign from my experience. And I guess it's good to be made aware that there's people like that out there too.
I want to steal prior things about this, because I feel like we're getting kind of far from what is actually stated in the episodes.
That's true. We're doing this whole psychoanalysis thing on someone in three steps removed from anything of concreteness.
Which is really the fun of this whole thing.
Yeah, it's true. We are eventually going to build up this Brian in our brains that's completely different from the actual Brian.
That's the entire point. That's what he's doing to Kowski, so...
That's true. Turnaround is fair play, motherfucker. I've been talking for a while, I think. Did you have something you would like to jump on?
He mentions in the first of the three episodes that he's finally trying to get off the, like, psychoanalyzing Kowski thing.
Mm-hmm.
Which is exactly the opposite of what we were just talking about.
Yes.
And he makes the point that, like, it's kind of harder to do that compared to, like, Worm or the Stephen King books, because, like, this book is about a philosophy.
Yeah.
Rather than just being, like, a narrative with whatever themes it has.
That's true. I think you could analyze the philosophy without trying to analyze the person behind it.
I think it is entirely possible to just read Methods of Rationality as any other story.
Mm-hmm.
But when you look at it, you can definitely connect things to Yudkowsky's other writings and stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, they talk about the Harry keeping the Patronus 2.0 secret later, and like this whole like input hazards thing that Brian has been talking about the entire show, and like that's something that like Miri actually does. Like,
yeah.
At some point, I think it decided to stop publishing papers because it didn't want to have to worry about figuring out whether or not they had hazards in them beforehand.
Mm-hmm.
And there was, of course, the whole basilisk thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, stuff in the story definitely has morals that are supposed to apply to the real world, and I think ignoring that, like, that's actually an aspect of the story that is there to be looked at, I think.
Yeah, and it's an aspect of the story that I really enjoy, too. I really prefer what people often refer to as message fiction. Like, I like my narratives to have some kind of point behind them. But, I mean, I can see if you disagree with the message, how that might be an issue for you.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I definitely think, like, it's interesting to draw the connections to other stuff in Castius. Said, and, like, there are a lot of themes here in the book with the mirror, and, well, I mean, the mirror, like, is Neu-Dewa. It's backwards.
Yeah.
Jump-weighted collision.
Yeah.
And stuff like that, where, like, they're ignoring that it is supposed to have real-world, applications, I guess, is like, I'm not sure that's actually what we want to be doing.
No, and that would be a misreading of the story too. If someone told you to ignore that, they'd be lying to you.
And so I think it might be more about just like the Harry being an arrogant jerk thing than stuff like that.
Yeah. So I kind of see Brian's point. If the philosophy itself rubs you the wrong way, you're not going to like this. Like, someone lent me the Screwtape Letters by C.S. Lewis, and they're like, yeah, this is great. It's a lot of fun. It's really snarky and humorous. And I started reading it, and like, I already knew C.S. Lewis is basically, you know, just hardcore pushing Catholicism all the time with all this stuff. It's not a secret. And I'm reading the Screwtape Letters, and I got through, I think, 2.5 of them, and I was like, I just cannot be force-fed any more bullshit Catholic propaganda. I'm done with these, and I'm sorry I couldn't keep reading this thing that you love, because, oh my god, fuck this stupid philosophy, and I don't care how fun these letters may be. They're bullshit, they're pushing bullshit. And, like, if you had a problem with transhumanism and humanist philosophy, and in general the idea that an AI is coming soon and we should be preparing for it, then I can see how this would really rub you the wrong way, too.
I'm not sure how much the AI is coming soon is really a theme of HMR at this point.
It's not specifically, but it's laying the groundwork.
There are connections to be drawn to it.
Yeah.
It makes a really quality thing among other stuff, but that doesn't, like, it's certainly not a main theme.
No, but I mean, it is one of the main reasons for the whole keeping knowledge secret theme.
That's true.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, I had an interesting back and forth with Brian because he, oh man, I wish I'd written it down, but like, I could not understand a thing that he said. It literally didn't make any sense to me. Oh yeah, he said, so who would even be hiding this knowledge? And I replied to him, obviously the people that have the knowledge. Like, who else possibly could? Either you know or you don't, and you decide to share it or you don't. Like, what are you talking about? And so he went on, gave a number of examples and questions where it became blindingly obvious that what he was thinking of is that the government would install some sort of knowledge czar who would then determine which knowledge can be shared and which can't, and then enforcement mechanisms would be used on people who shared the knowledge that was, you know, deemed unshareable. And then it suddenly finally all made sense, right? Like, we were coming at this from such drastically different positions that of course there was this misconnect. And I told him, oh no, if that's what was being proposed, I would be absolutely with you too. It would never work, plus it's terrible and stupid, and you know, has horrible consequences for democracy and the government. What Eliezer is saying is, like, if you have discovered something, if you are one of the ground level researchers, maybe instead of blabbing it to the entire world, think for just a couple minutes, is this possibly dangerous? And if it's really dangerous, should I maybe not share it with people or be extremely circumspect about who I do share it with, you know? Like, literally, if you have found this knowledge somehow in the world, think before sharing it if you think it might be dangerous. And at that point, he was like, oh, yeah, well, okay, that's totally fine. That makes sense. And I was like, oh, okay, so we just were thinking of two different things when we were thinking of, you know, when should you hide knowledge and that sort of thing.
That's kind of strange to me because it seems pretty clear, like, with what Harry, like, we actually see an example of Harry deciding to keep knowledge secret here.
Yeah. No, I mean, exactly, but I think we also have the extra inferential steps that we already know what Eliezer's talking about because we've read the sequences, whereas someone who came into this blind, probably the only experience they have on this sort of thing is, like, you know, government czar saying, like, this drug is okay to take and this drug isn't, and these words are okay to say and these words aren't. And so, of course, they would pattern match this to the same thing.
Yeah, I can see how you're, like, extrapolating to the real world case separate from the methods of rationality one. You might look at it differently if you don't know.
All right.
Well, stuff like Mary keeping things secret.
Yeah, if all you had to go on was how censorship has worked traditionally. So that was an interesting conversation. I was glad I had it. I think it might change how he approaches this when it shows up again later on in the story.
Yeah, that makes a lot about what he's been going on about this whole time.
Yeah.
I think they were both, Stephen and Brian, were confused about, like, why they don't want Harry, the fact that Harry killed a Dementor getting public, and why they, like, removed the memories from the orders.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's, at least it was very clear to me that this is probably another case of the something the Dark Lord knows not thing.
Oh, yes. See, I was thinking it was more of a thing to protect Harry, like, you don't want it getting out that he has this secret power. But okay, now that you mention it, that's literally the same thing, right? I just wasn't thinking.
The partial transfiguration, right?
Yeah, they did.
If they do it for something as small as, well, that's not exactly small, but
yeah,
for something like that, something as significant as killing a Dementor, all the more so.
Yeah. They definitely know that Harry is going to need a power that the Dark Lord knows not, and so, yeah, they're keeping it safe.
Of course, not exactly keeping the Dark Lord from harm.
No. But, you know, they didn't know that at the time.
Yeah. So what were you going to say?
Oh, I was going to say, I think this is, because you mentioned the thing about, like, Harry being an asshole, and how Brian's kind of got a thing about that. He, again, this is something he posted on the Bayesian Conspiracy Discord, which I thought it was, I don't want to psychoanalyze Brian, but I think you can often, like, learn a lot. When people read fiction, they read a lot of their own lives into it, which is what makes it powerful, right? That's one of the reasons we read it. We want to be able to relate to these things. But sometimes when you see people interpreting something in a certain way that you think is wrong, it really tells you a lot about, like, how they're reading into things. So Brian says, on the whole Harry is an asshole thing, that it is absolutely because I did act like that and still do act like that that it bothers me so much. I know how bad I used to be. It reminds me what a douche I was. And it makes the self-loathing that caused it to feel not nearly as far away in my rearview mirror as I thought. I am a worthless, weird, fat loser that nobody will ever like, but at least I'm smarter than these plebs. And it's, and here's like the thing that really interested me, and it's so glaringly obvious that's what's going on right under the surface with Harry that it makes me really uncomfortable. And, like, I don't think that that is glaringly obvious at all. I think Harry is fed up with people a lot and doesn't suffer fools gladly, but it does not... I never got the feeling that he thought I'm a worthless, weird, fat loser that no one will ever like, but at least I'm smarter than people. And the fact that Brian thinks it's glaringly obvious is, I don't know, I think it's interesting. Within Reason commented on this to Brian, saying, does that really seem like what's going on with Harry? He's got a lot going for him other than being smart. He's popular. Girls have crushes on him. He's able to bend adults to his will. He can do magic. I don't see him clinging to his intelligence like it's his one redeeming quality. And, you know, I think Within is right on this, that, like, yeah, Harry is sometimes a bit arrogant, but he's not this, like, self-loathing, hate-filled, weird fat loser that Brian says, like he's making him out to be. He just has a bit of an attitude, a bit of snark to him.
Yeah, that... Huh. I don't think I have much to add on that, but that is interesting.
It makes me all... be able to see where Brian's coming from a bit more, that this is how he reads Harry. It makes me want to be more forgiving of his reading of Harry, since, you know, he's got this personal emotional hang-up.
Yeah. I mean, he's talked about, like, some of that on the podcast itself, but the, I guess, self-loathing aspect was not brought up.
Yeah. I always just thought, like, oh, he hates Harry because people who think they're too high status than they really are should be beat down. And now I'm like, oh, no, he hates Harry because he hated himself for a while. And this is, you know, bringing back flashes of that.
Mm-hmm. I mean, he talked about, like, how he saw himself in Harry and that's what bothered him.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, several times throughout the podcast.
That's true.
But... he did not go into that much detail on what it was like for him.
Yeah, exactly. I think that made a difference to me.
Yeah, definitely.
I did want to... So this is a thing that I saw after I signed on to the Doofcast Discord. And like I said, there's... I don't know. I think the amount of traffic on the two Discords is about equal. They will spike at different times. But this was an interesting thing. Isaac from their Discord says that Harry thinks, well, I'd better go off and love something then. That's bound to help me defeat the Dark Lord. when he's talking to Dumbledore in his office. But Isaac points out, Isaac points out that's basically the same advice that the Hat gave him. He needs to really strengthen his light side. And he, unfortunately, Harry does not pick up that advice either from the Hat or from Dumbledore.
Yeah, but I would say, like, at the end of the story, the something to protect is how he wins.
Yeah.
So, that actually does end up being how he defeats Star-Lord.
Yeah, damn, you're right. That's cool, and it kind of ties back to the original canon story of, like, having something to love and protect as well.
Yeah, I didn't, think about that. When I was drawing connections between the stories, it was always, like, differing perspectives on death.
Yeah.
Where, like, just the connection with the, like, Peril Brothers and all that is just, Peveril?
Yes, Peveril.
Like, all that is just crazy. It's amazing that it just, like,
yes,
happened to tie into this theme so well.
Yeah. And the fact that, like, the quote on the gravestone is the anti-death quote, and it's actually in canon, and Rowling just, like, didn't make the connection. It's perfect.
It is.
Like, sometimes the world just comes together, and you're like, how is this not planned out by some awesome writing architect person?
There's just two, like, entirely different ways to interpret overcoming death.
Yeah.
It's neat.
Oh. Please go on.
Sure. They have a discussion on cryonics during the chapter 39 discussion with Dumbledore.
Yes.
And Brian brings up a lot of points that I had not really considered before.
Mm-hmm.
Like the emotional impact of, like, being there on your deathbed, like, unsure whether or not you're about to be resurrected. Like, I was always just, look at the money living forever. Obviously, the monetary cost is basically irrelevant. Yeah. Especially since it's, like, actually not all that much.
Right.
The emotional costs could be pretty cool, I guess, depending on what the actual chances of a working are.
Yeah.
I've thought about how, like, you have a very different approach to the end of your first life if you're signed up for cryonics.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that there could be an emotional cost to that difference.
Yeah. I mean, yes, I agree. Like, there's a reason people have these religions and these stories, right? It obviously does make it easier to accept your own death and also to accept the people that you love dying. And there is a cost associated with rejecting those stories, but it's not...
I think that's what Brian was talking about.
No.
Because I think cryonics is closer to being one of those stories, and that, like, it prevents you from accepting the fact that, like, there's just nothing.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, the difference is that cryonics, like, you actually might not be.
Right, right. Well, I think, I mean, there's two differences. One of them being that, you know, there's actual possibility of it happening, but the other difference is that it's not at all guaranteed. Like, all these other stories are, yep, you die, and then you go to this place. Whereas cryonics is like...
Well, hell is part of many religions.
Yeah, but most people that have a belief in a bad place as well as a good place almost invariably think, yeah, I'm going to the good place. Whereas with cryonics, it's like, well, I might wake up in the future, maybe 5%. Those aren't great odds. That's like rolling a natural 20. gonna see what happens.
I'm sort of just ignoring the odds for my emotional well-being.
Yeah.
I think they might be higher than that, but I don't really want to actually figure it out.
Right.
It's relevant to a decision I'm making.
Yeah. And, I mean, the thing is, a lot of people, atheists have existed since the first gods were invented, right? There's always been someone who's like, no, that sounds like bullshit.
I mean, probably.
Well, they've existed for at least as long as... We have documented evidence to at least going back to the ancient Greeks, right? Where there were already people talking about, yeah, that, sure, and if the animals invented gods, they would all look like animals, too. And so there have always been atheists around, so it's obviously not an insurmountable cost. Like, you can eventually get to the acceptance that you're gonna die, and it's gonna suck, but there's nothing you can do about it.
Can you? Or are, is there just, like, I mean... I feel like it might be that people are, like, just not really actually understanding death on to its full extent, rather than that they're understanding it and coming to accept it.
Why do you think that? I mean, obviously there's a lot of people that don't, but there are people that do.
I think there probably are some people who do. But I think it's probably just as common that even among atheists, they are not really understanding it.
That's...
Like, I think the majority of, like, non-religious people are, like, full-on atheists.
Right.
In the same sense that, like, rationalists are.
Yeah, most of them just kind of don't think about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, I guess when I'm thinking about the ancient atheists, I'm thinking more about, like, Marcus Aurelius and people who wrote about, like, you just have to accept these things because this is how it is, and coming up with philosophies to deal with that. Whereas, yeah, you're right. Most people were not like that. Most people didn't sit down and scribe out their thoughts. They were just like, okay, gotta go out to the fields today.
I mean, I did not write a novel about cosmic horror in ancient times.
Okay. It took me a second to realize you were talking about me there. Thank you, I am flattered. But, yeah, no, I mean, I agree it's definitely an emotional cost. And I think that's the reason that Harry hides Patronus 2.0, right? Because he knows a lot of people won't be able to deal with that cost, and so they'll lose their animal Patronus and not have a human Patronus to fall back on. It's the same kind of... It's basically the same thing Brian was saying, right?
Because, like, Harry has hope.
Yeah.
It's hope because, well, it seems pretty likely that everything will work out in the Methods of Rationality universe. In real life, like, it's not... There is a solid chance that everything just goes horribly.
Yeah.
And we all die.
Yeah.
And, like, it's difficult because you do have to have hope for the future because the future could be good.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you focusing on that too much makes it difficult to actually accept the fact that chances are maybe it won't.
Right. No, I mean, you're right. It's times like this where I almost feel like, you know, one of those religionists that says, you know, we are in the period before Easter where all we have is hope because God is dead, and we don't know that he's coming back in 3 days. We haven't gotten to Easter yet. It's one of my more favorite stories about, you know, what it means to live in hope. And, you know, it's based on a myth, but it still, it gets the emotion across, and gosh, I'll see if I can find a link to it, but it's, yeah, it's like, we're living in the period after God is dead, and we don't know if things will ever be good again. But we gotta have hope, because they could be, and what else can you do but have hope and go forward? This got a lot more serious than I intended for a meta podcast.
Is this 2 layers of meta? I mean...
Is it?
I don't know if literature analysis counts as meta.
Okay. Well, one layer then. I kind of think it does.
But then this whole, is Methods of Rationality being a fanfic layer?
Oh, that's a good point. Yes. So, we'd be like 3 levels up now?
I don't know. It all comes down to what you count, and that's...
Yeah.
Because, I mean, there's a sense in which Harry Potter, the originals, is a commentary on the real world.
Yes.
Rather than just its own thing.
Yeah.
So, does Harry Potter count as a layer?
You know, what do they say? Everything's a remix?
Real life is the only thing that isn't a remix. And even then, our understanding of real life is definitely not the same thing as how the actual atoms are moving around.
Right. Oh, well, did we want to move on to another point then?
If you have anything.
Let's see. I had a couple things. The thing I said I was going to rail about earlier, I'll rail out some other time.
I have one thing.
Okay, go ahead.
Brian remarks that he thinks Dumbledore doesn't really think all that cliche stuff.
Mm.
Dumbledore totally does think all that cliche stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Not exactly in those terms, but, like, for one thing, he's like, correct.
Yes.
I
think that kind of goes back to Brian's point about the Rosencrantz and Guildenstern thing, that, like, Dumbledore really does believe he's in a story, and it's not like a literal story, like Guildenstern and Rosencrantz, they're like, oh, we're inside a play written by someone, but Dumbledore thinks... Yeah. Yes, but Dumbledore thinks that he is in some sort of grand narrative that is being played out somehow, so these narrative rules are important and mean things. So, in that case, he's kind of right.
He says, like, there's something deeper going on with Dumbledore, and so he thinks that's, like, how Dumbledore probably is acting and doesn't actually believe all these stuff, but it's entirely the opposite. There's something deeper going on with Dumbledore. And it is that he actually has a reason to be acting like this.
Yeah. And that's the he's seen all prophecies thing, right?
The world of HPMR actually does run on narrative.
Yeah, yeah.
Both because it is a book and because prophecies.
Right. That's how their world actually works. I thought it was cool that Brian got the Death Eater thing right away. That the Dementor, the personification of death, was destroyed, and when they asked what do we tell the ministry happened to the Dementor, he says, tell them I ate it. And Brian was like, oh, because he's a Death Eater, I get it. And and I did not get it when I read that. I thought he was just, like, you know, being silly or something. And it wasn't until someone pointed that out to me many chapters later that I was like, oh.
I didn't get that until now.
Okay.
Like, I heard them talking about how, like, oh, that's a weird thing. Like, I mean, like, I thought it was, like, Voldemort, like, he, you know, with the Horcruxes, did not, like, defeated death.
Yeah, yeah.
In some sense.
That's why they keep saying, you know, we'll get you Riddle or something.
Right. Well, I don't think they say Riddle because... Didn't everyone else hear it?
They, at some point, they definitely said Riddle because that was the word that kept echoing in Harry's mind, right?
Echo?
That was...
I don't remember.
I think that was, like, one of the final lines. This one word kept echoing in his head, and he stopped and thought, okay, if this is a riddle, what's the answer? And that's where you're like, oh, the word that was echoing was Riddle. And that is, again, something I did not get because... I was one of the people who was like, obviously, Quirrell is not Voldemort, because Voldemort is stupid and cartoonishly evil, and Quirrell is very smart and only a little bit Slytherin. Or only a little bit evil and a whole lot Slytherin. So I didn't put together that he was Voldemort, which is one of the reasons I didn't put together that he was saying, I'm a Death Eater. And I also didn't ever get for a long time that any references to Riddle were also references to Quirrell, so... When the Dementors are like, ah, we're coming for you, Riddle, 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 Riddle. Like, I don't know. I didn't know why the word Riddle was echoing in Harry's mind until my second reread. Or until my first reread. And then I was like, ah.
And then it's like, I don't think Quirrell solved the Dementor at all.
Did he solve
it? Though that the Dementors are death.
I think Quirrell does, yes. Otherwise, why would he have said that, tell them I ate it, as a pun on his organization?
Right, yeah, but I'm wondering if that was just, like, a joke by Yudkowsky.
Oh.
Quirrell was thinking when he said that.
So right now I'm assuming it's something Quirrell was thinking, but you're right, it could have been an in-joke, like the marked him as his equal thing. Huh.
Well, I feel like that's just the prophecy being weird.
Yeah.
More than... Well, obviously it's also a joke to be casting.
Yes.
I don't think there was a part of the prophecy about the psyche stuff.
No, no. Certainly wasn't.
But, I don't know. It could go either way on that thing. Because, like, they... Or Harry at least thinks about, like, who... There probably have been... He thinks there probably have been people who figured out what the mentors are in the past. I think he says probably Gotcha Gryffindor and...
Yeah.
Claude.
Yeah.
Those two, at least. But he doesn't... I don't think he speculates that Quirrell might have.
Okay.
I'm not sure. I think I would have heard that in the episode.
Okay.
But it's certainly possible that he has. He is smart. Among other things.
I don't... Yeah. Now I'm questioning myself. I don't know. Speaking of things that you don't realize until a reread when you know that Quirrell is Voldemort, in the Doofcast Discord, D-Dev said... regarding Hermione kissing Harry to save him. I just realized that the kiss to save Harry from the Dementor worked not because Riddle had never... Okay. You know what? Instead of reading this, I'm going to summarize basically what Brian said. Brian pointed out that, like, the evil Harry had an answer to everything that annoyed him. That, like, people were annoying, they should die. People were doing this, they should die. People were doing that, they should be tortured, but that's a pain in the butt, so they should die. And here's a way that maybe we could make them all die. And I don't know how he, like, the way he said this, it felt to me like, oh my god, he knows he's Voldemort, he knows that Harry Potter is Voldemort, except of course he doesn't. But the impression you get when you're listening to him is you realize, oh my god, that was Harry channeling the cached thoughts of Voldemort. Like, Voldemort already has gone through very, very many scenarios with these sorts of things, and he already has his stock answers picked out. He knows that when this happens, you kill someone. When this happens, you torture them. And, like, all those, everything that he's confronted with is just a stock answer that Voldemort would do that has been dredged up out of Harry's mind by the Dementor, you know, pulling up that Voldemort aspect of him. And then he got kissed. And the routine that was pulling out the answers Voldemort would give in Harry's brain just shuddered to a complete stop and threw an error, because never in his life had Voldemort even considered something like, someone might kiss me. Like, there was no need to apprehend what to do in that situation. And so, like, Harry himself had to come up with some sort of answer, and that was kind of sort of like rebooted him back into Harry mode, that there wasn't a Voldemort answer for that. And D-Dev points out that that is, like, the fact that Riddle had never even contemplated that possibility in to any degree, just sort of, and didn't have a response to it, shows you what a sad and broken human Riddle was. And, like, I really felt sad for Riddle at that point. And it was also, like, a very cool thing that somehow Brian found this, and that D-Dev made this connection. That, yeah, that is what saved Harry. And I never picked that up before until just now, and I've read this thing, you know, numerous times. So yeah, that was a cool insight, and that is very sad about Riddle.
It is. Yeah, Brian's whole take there on how exactly Harry being pulled up, like, the mechanics of it, were not really clear to me when I first read it. Mm. Yeah, it's a really cool observation, Maya. And the connection, of course.
Yeah. Alright, I also had something that Steven said, but at this point it's getting pretty long, and maybe we can bring it up next time.
I mean, I have plenty of time. Do you go to sleep for another couple hours, so...
I
want to bring it up now.
I... sure, I guess. It was that Stephen said, God, I don't remember which episode this was in anymore, but Stephen said that, like, Spartan children must be more mature because they go through all the shit early in their lives, like being subjected to their parents abandoning them, and they have to fend for themselves, and they beat each other up in these horrible physical contests. And, like, I disagree strongly. I don't think that makes you more mature. I think the Spartan children would have been much more calloused, definitely. They would have had, you know, layers of emotional armor that they've stacked on themselves because they'd had to survive that, but I don't think that's the same as maturity. I mean, I agree that a lot of people become more emotionally calloused as they get older, in part just because, you know, the longer you go on living, the more times you're going to get kicked in the teeth by life, and sometimes you develop armors, but I don't think that translates to maturity, that those Spartan kids would be just as immature as most kids their age, and maybe even more so because they haven't had opportunities to grow in important ways. They just have a toughness and callousness about them, which is different.
Yeah, I mean, I think they're probably on that list for sure. I think that challenges can cause maturity in some ways, but I mean, I think maturity has a lot of different aspects to it.
Yeah.
Probably.
Yeah.
So, I don't know.
You're right. Many challenges, the things that force you to rely upon yourself and build up yourself to overcome them, would definitely make you more mature. I'm just not sure.
I'm not sure you're really building up yourself to overcome that when you're just, like, adding on layers of emotional armor. So.
Exactly. I think that's what I was trying to get at. That there, you can put on emotional armor, or you can build yourself up, and maybe sometimes you do both, but they aren't necessarily the same thing. Like, I would think lots of times that sort of treatment could stunt your development. I've heard that people who suffer abuse and trauma often become kind of somewhat stunted in some aspects at that age when they're subjected to it, and then later have to go back and build through that.
I feel like that happens to some extent to almost everyone.
Yeah. We all need therapy.
Well, I don't know how much actual therapy is going to help everyone, but, like, idealized therapy, everyone needs.
Yes, yes. I suppose we all need psychic surgery once that becomes a thing.
I have something at some point.
Yeah, I don't know. You know what? I'm not going to say anything bad about therapy because it helps a lot of people, so fuck that.
I mean, therapy is great. I've been to therapy before when I came out to my parents, and it did not help me at all.
Yeah.
I mean, the problems I had with regards to that were not things that therapy could really overcome.
Right. That's been my experience as well, that I've gone through therapy a number of times, and every now and then it's given me the excuse to do what I kind of knew had to be done anyway, but I don't really think I've yet to meet a therapy that has helped me really in any way. But maybe there is one out there, who knows?
Yeah, so, I mean, everyone needs something like that, but I don't know if actual therapy is going to accomplish that for all people.
Yes. Everyone needs someone to go back and hack their mind and fix the broken parts.
I'm not sure if that's exactly what I mean. All the problems for me would probably be better than status quo, but I feel like there are intermediate options there.
Yeah. We don't want to go the wireheading route, unless we're named Wes Frenza. Alright, well, one thing that I wanted to end with was someone in the Doof Discord linked a extremely short story that was posted on the HPMOR subreddit called The Methods of Rationality in Harry Potter, which is basically just reverse Harry Potter and the Methods of Rationality, where Harry starts out as a wizard born to a wizarding family, except he doesn't have any wizarding powers, unfortunately. He's, what do they call, duds or whatever they are?
Isn't that squibs?
Is that what a squib is? I think you're right, that is what a squib is.
Is that? I mean, I don't think squids have, like, full magic powers, but they're not, like, the same thing as muggles.
Yeah. But based...
I mean, maybe there's something even more magically sensitive than squids are, I don't know.
Yeah, but basically he's born to, Lily and James. They never died, they're full wizards, but he doesn't have any magic powers at all. And then a letter arrives from Harvard, and he's been accepted into Muggle school, where they will teach him the secrets of science. And he's, like, so excited. He's like, finally, I get to learn how to hack reality instead of just waving a stupid wand around and fixing everything, you know? And it's basically chapter one of Harry Potter Methods of Rationality, except written completely flipped, you know, mirror imaged. And it is just so wonderful and great and funny. And it's like 2,000 words. It's almost nothing. Probably less than that. It's like 5 pages long, but I highly recommend it. It was a lot of fun to read.
That sounds great.
And that's all I got for this week. I have some other notes, but I'm sure I'll bring them up next time, since next time they're just doing a retrospective anyway. Do you have anything?
I don't think so.
Okay. Well, thank you for joining me again, and let's do this again in a week or two.
Yeah, or three.
Or three, yes, depending on how much there is to talk about.
Was it the decision based on how much there was to talk about, or did you just, like, not get around to, I guess you were scheduling these until, until, like, Monday?
It was kind of both. Like, my previous week was a little bit full, but I could have made, the one before this latest episode came out, I could have made time for it, but I was like, I want to hear what they have to say about the full Dementor thing first, you know? And then I suddenly had a lot more to talk about, and turns out I had more to talk about than we could fit into a episode, so I will have more next time.
Okay. This episode has already been the longest one.
How long have we been going?
An hour, 10.
Okay. And I'm probably going to put in, like, 10 minutes of our chat from last time at the front. Maybe. Or maybe just release that as a special separate thing, like you said, episode 4.5.
It's like April 1st, you could just release that and play this whole episode.
Release the real one tomorrow?
Yeah.
Okay, then I will do that.
Yeah, that's a good idea. You should post it in the Doof Discord.
I don't know if the Doof Discord would be interested in that, though, because we're...
I don't know. I feel like they should at least be aware it exists. Even if you're not, like, advertising it every time I release one.
Okay. All right. I'll ask Steven what he thinks. And if Steven thinks it's a good idea, then I'll do it.
Okay.
And if you were to join the Doofcast and do it yourself, well, there's nothing I can do about that. So.
Is the Discord is for Patreon only, right?
Yes. But it's, I think $1 a month is the lowest level. So it depends, you know, but yeah, that is the for Patreons only. And I don't know. I listened to their Doofcast stuff too, and I really enjoy it. So I was like, yeah, I can throw them $1 a month. And that was like about a year ago. And I lost my Discord invite because I never went there. And then when I heard they started talking about this on it, I had to go dig it up and like go join. I was like, okay, cool.
Maybe I can funnel the money from my Patreon to that.
Oh.
I made a Patreon, mostly as a joke, but I'm actually getting money for some reason.
Nice.
For my Minecraft map.
Oh, that is awesome. Congratulations.
I am making $1 a month, which is... I need to join the Doofcast Discord.
Perfect. I think you can do that. You should give it a try.
Sweet.
Your Minecraft map has funded your Doofcast addiction.
Perfect.
All right, well then I'll talk to you later on sometime.
See ya.
Have a good evening.